All right, we are in RX World again with Bart JF to Smet.
Yes, that's right.
How are you doing?
Good, how about you?
Good, man. Yeah. So last time we talked, you were in Beta 2 World.
Yes, yep.
And now you guys are releasing Release Candidate.
Release Candidate of RxV2, yes.
Congratulations.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, yep.
And I wanted to come and kind of dig in, you know, have you do your canonical whiteboarding.
Sure, yep.
And tell us what exactly we have in store.
Okay, well, again, a lot of change. Under the cover, luckily. Not that much, user visible change, but all, I would say, improvements for quality, performance, those kind of things. Support for Windows 8 release preview. RX beta didn't quite work there because there were some changes to the API surface in Windows 8, like dispatcher signatures had changed. So we had to do a little bit of work there to make it work. So we did that. Then lots of things with regards to performance, reliability, so we've continued the performance work. Also support for .NET 4, so we actually had .NET 4.5, Silverlight 5, Windows Phone 7, and Metro. Mm-hmm. We're adding 4.0 to that, not enabled by default in the installer, but if you still are on 4.0, you can basically check it on, and you will actually get the .NET 4.0 assemblies as well. The reason it's not in there by default is it sort of messes up the add reference dialog. If you have all the versions and then you're in 4.5 and you see two copies, that kind of thing. So, but we can still build it for .NET 4. We're just not taking advantage of features that don't exist, of course, like exception dispatch info. We talked about that before to get like nice call stacks. That we can't do in .NET 4. And so other things like task.delay, which we use in certain places, well, it doesn't exist there. So so there are some differences in terms of how it behaves, but it's largely the same, other than some internal details. So other than that, we've done major refactorings in, I would say, like three areas. Not refactorings in terms of the assembly surface. That's all fixed and set in stone at this point. But we've actually changed the way we deal with time, the notion of time. There are a lot of, situations where, and I will talk a little bit more about that on the whiteboard, where our notion of absolute time sort of gave people a false sense of security. And I will talk about that in just a moment in more detail, but let's first go to the list of things, right? So the time notion, then also the error handling notion. So taking up RX and running it in more server workloads means that you want to be reliable. If you hand out an observable to someone and they throw an exception in the callbacks, basically you've given them a ticket to basically crash your process, right? Like you're just giving out the observable and bad things can happen. And so that doesn't really happen with enumerables, to draw that analogy. If you have an IEnumerable that represents a database and you start enumerating over it and you throw an exception, you're the one who's going to die. The exception is going to unwind your stack. But in observables, the direction of calls goes differently. It's the notifications on the observer that come in, and you have to handle those. And when you throw there, well, it's the guy who sent out the message that's ultimately going to receive the exception. And so we did some work to allow people to catch those exceptions in a more disciplined way, essentially. And then some other things that were sort of the fallout from certain behavior, and for example, Windows runtime, is how we deal with exceptions in the context of .NET or WinRT events. And that's also a pretty subtle thing. Like if you do from event pattern, in RX, you basically get an observable that when you subscribe, will actually hook up an event handler to the underlying event. Now it turns out in different UI frameworks, they are either forgiving or non-forgiving of where you hook up your event handlers. Hmm. Like I talked actually to the Metro people, I used to work with them when I was in the WPF land. A lot of those people are the same actually. And so we went through the history there of like WPF and Silverlight and Metro and like all those platforms, how they deal with, attaching events to the controls. And it turns out in WinRT it's a very disciplined way, like in Windows XAML, the Metro, language.
Yep.
Over there, there's a disciplined way of, if you try to add your event handlers or remove them from anywhere else than the UI thread, you get an exception. You're not doing this on the right context. Now that's a problem with Rx, because in Rx, observables can be subscribed to anywhere. And subscribing to a from event pattern means hooking up the event handler. So where do we do that? And there are ways of doing that manually, but they are subtle. Things like subscribe on dispatcher is something we've had since day one in Rx, but people are often confused between subscribe all and observe all. Like there are those two things and they play different roles. And so we decided to sort of, you know, go for the change insight from event pattern, where we said like this one needs to be aware of where the subscription is going to happen and we'll make it happen in the right place. So it's not the ideal situation that thing all of a sudden needs to know about it, but it's still at the edge of Rx. Like, you know, observable.from something typically does things you may not expect it to do, but it's for the better. And in this case, the better means not getting an exception when you use from event pattern, which arguably is a good thing. So so we can talk more about how all of that stuff works as well. But maybe we should go back to the beginning of the list and start talking about time, maybe on the whiteboard.
Absolutely. Yep. It's time for time.
Time for time, yeah.
And you have quite the whiteboard.
Oh, I will actually do some cleanup here. You can see we're busy, right?
Yeah, you guys are busy.
So what's up with time, right?
I ask that all the time.
Yes. Well, time flies, that's for sure. So the problems we have with time include how we deal with time. So let's actually give a little code fragment here and see what it basically does. Like if we do observable dot timer, let's actually do interval, which is a recurring timer, of, and I will use some pseudo syntax, 1 second, which is really time span from seconds, that kind of thing, right? And so I have this guy sitting here, x is equals observable interval, which is an observable of long that ticks every second. Now the question for the audience is, like if I draw this diagram, and actually maybe you can answer it as well.
Okay.
X is dot subscribe, right? Of x goes to, and then I'll use this common syntax, user code, like this. If you look at this in a diagram, right, the time you subscribe to the sequence is time 0, okay? And then basically we'll get events firing at time 0, time 1, time 2, time 3, and so on. Mm-hmm. That are the callbacks to the user, right? Now what's that distance in here? Is that distance, it's of course 1 second, because that's what I asked it to do. But what is it between? Is it 1 second between the beginning of those dots, or is it 1 second between something else?
Hmm.
And so the answer is kind of arbitrary. I don't know what you would say, like, you know, because you have user code sitting here.
Yeah.
This user code may take a long time. Then does it mean that everything sort of, is it 1 second from here, or is it 1 second from the beginning of the user code? Well, what would be the answer, right? And like,
it depends.
Yes, it depends. And so in Rx, we actually said we want to go for one interpretation of this. Well, that's actually what we did in observable interval and observable time, where we said it's from the beginning. So basically, what that means is you can sort of set your clock by it, right? If in the user code you do like a console.writeline of datetime offset.now or datetime.now, any of those guys, like you would see that thing go up in increments of 1 second. Now that by itself is also a little strange, and I will talk about that separately, but what you would see for sure is differences of 1 second, even if after this thing you would do a thread.sleep of say 500 milliseconds, which means you're sort of like running for 500 milliseconds after printing and all of those guys, your time wouldn't be distorted.
Mm.
So the user code isn't causing slippage. That's the way I call it. I don't call it drift because I use that for something else. And so in Rx we said, well, it's always between the beginning of things. So how do we do that? That's the other question. Well, if you look at the iScheduler interface that we've actually had in Rx since, you know, 1.0 RTM essentially.
Sure.
The release candidate, actually we introduced some changes there, but the iScheduler interface basically has a method called schedule, which returns an iDisposable, the usual way of doing things in Rx. It takes in some state parameter, and then what it takes in is the state, the time span, which is the due time, and it takes in a func of iScheduler, comma, the state, which returns an iDisposable. And that's the action, A. So this allows you to parameterize the work with a state, say when it's due, and actually have some recursive function that can come back to the scheduler to run new work. Pretty straightforward, and you can return disposables, meaning that all the recursive guys can return the handles to cancel them. You can collect them up and hand them out. That's basically what's going on here. Now, the thing with this one is, this is a single shot timer. The way you talk to this guy is, do something at that time. So it's not a recurring timer at all. So how do we do observable interval using that guy? Well, the answer is in Rx we have this notion of recursive scheduling. So we actually close over this whole animal in some sense, and we give you a way of, through an extension method on iScheduler, to do things recursively. And so the way that actually looks is, you actually write it over here. If I have a scheduler S, I can write S.schedule, say of 42, comma, x, comma, self goes to, and then I can do some work here, like bumping something out on an observer, for example, like observer on next, let me actually write on next here, on next of x, and then after that I can call self with x plus 1. And so what this does is, it calls it initially with 42, coming in through x, it does the on next, and then it recurses with 43. So this code sort of goes in circles. It doesn't do a go-to or anything, it basically yields to the scheduler, schedules itself again. So you can have interleaving of work here. Nice. Which means it's fair, like for UI schedulers and things, you want other things to happen. So those are small units of work. Now of course the danger here is, on next can take arbitrarily long, because we're reaching out to user code, that those are all those slippage points. So how do we correct for the slippage using this recursive thing? And that's where actually, you know, all the sort of weird things started to happen. The way we did that was actually by saying, look, what we can do is, outside this thing we can say something like datetime, really datetime offset, next equals now plus 1 second. So we know the next time we are due. And then basically we start running code. And actually there is an overload to this schedule thing that also takes in a time span over here, like time span over here and a time span over there. So you can basically say, do this thing at that point, and then at the relative time from the end, you pass in a new time span here. And so what happened here is basically we called on next, and then we basically over here in this piece of code, we actually reevaluated now minus next. So we say like, what's the time now? What's the next time we are due? And then based on that computation, we would actually compute the relative time for the next time. So what that means is, like at the beginning here, say it's 1 a.m., right? This time would be next time, and we update that next time in that loop as well, of course, would be 1 a.m. plus 1 second, right? We start running user code, and at this point we come to the conclusion, oh, we're already half a second far. So now we only need to schedule ourselves for 500 milliseconds. Because we do the subtraction of this minus now, we have the remainder. And then we schedule ourselves.
Okay.
So that's how it worked in our XP1. There are a couple of unfortunate things about this, and I actually mentioned it in the introduction that it gives a false sense of security.
Yeah.
Let me actually talk about that a little bit as well. But first of all, the first problem is there is some distributed notion of now sitting here. So if you look at this piece of code is written in the link layer. A And as you know, there are like three layers in Rx, or actually two important ones in this case. You have Link and you have the schedulers. Schedulers know about the current time. Now all of a sudden we have a copy of the current time sitting in here. That's a little bit fishy by itself, like, because, you know, we sort of like have notions of this time everywhere in the system now. You just move this thing here. Now the problem is, if the system clock changes, we've actually had a lot of, you know, reports on the forums at some point where people said the system clock has changed and this thing doesn't do anything. Because, like, you know, if you have your time sitting here, like your system clock, and it's 1 a.m., 2 a.m., 3 a.m., mm-hmm. and like we compute the next due time, it would actually compute like how long we have to wait till we do the next thing. But then if the clock changes under us, we haven't seen that. Like, you know, the time has gone backwards or forward, and you get all sorts of things. Either you get too much the next time, because the next time the timer fires, it says it's 2 a.m., and then, you know, it looks at like it's due time. Oh, I was due at like 5 a.m. Mm. Like, so there are 3 hours that sort of went by. Like, what's going on here? So either it would try to catch up by continuously doing work, or it would just keep silent for a long time. Mm. If your clock went one way, it actually would catch up. In the other case, it would actually just be silent for a long time.
Sure.
And so that wasn't good. In fact, we had an issue with that on Windows Phone. Because on Windows Phone, you can actually have this situation of the system clock seemingly changing underneath you. That's when your app goes into the dormant state. Mm. Your app goes into the dormant state, the user goes to sleep and just, you know, presses the home button or something. One of the gestures keeps the application sort of running but suspended. Mm-hmm. And then the user wakes up again in the morning, goes back to the app, and the app starts just giving a floodload of events. Because, like, it's trying to catch up for all the hours that the user was asleep. Like, if you had a timer that recurs every second or something, well, 3,600 seconds per hour, mm-hmm. and then 8 hours of sleep, that's 144,000 or something.
Yeah.
Like, you know, or...
It's a lot of events.
A lot of events, you know? And so that would actually drain batteries.
Sure.
So what do you do with that? You actually say, well, either if you notice when you're back in this piece of code that you're sort of running long way in the future or long way in the past, you need to do some corrective measures. Maybe you need to reset the timer or something. Mm. But then you're sort of losing events. Like, there is no correct answer. Does it mean the time when the application is alive, or does it mean the time that, based on the absolute time, right? Mm. Like, is the absolute time really the authority, or is it really the fact that you want to have a periodic timer for once a second when the application was running? Like, no good answers there. And so we had an ad hoc fix for that, and all sorts of things happened there. So we didn't quite like this relying on absolute time anymore. And there are lots of interesting complications with absolute time. For example, if you move your system clock forward just a little bit, the way the absolute time, your system clock actually behaves, is not necessarily by making a jump. What happens if you have MTP enabled on your system and your jump forward or backward in time is small? What it will do is that every time the CPU ticks, it will either increment your clock with more than the frequency of the CPU or less. So basically the CPU clock is like this. It ticks every so often, and there are magic numbers like 15.6 milliseconds that you might have seen, you know, in various places. But so that's your CPU clock. And then you have your wall clock time, the thing you see in your system tray. And basically what happens is every time the CPU clock goes, it basically increments this clock as well. Now, this thing is not necessarily related in milliseconds to UTC time or anything like GPS time or anything. Like, this is just like how your hardware is ticking, which isn't calibrated to do the same thing as like MTP or atomic clocks or something. So basically what Windows has is something like called get system time adjustment. And that's basically saying every time this clock goes, how much this guy needs to increment. And if that's the same thing, that means your CPU is actually doing very well. It's like incrementing 15.6 every time. Now, if the clock actually changes, like, you know, the MTP server synchronizes with your machine and you can trigger that, actually, you can actually see this. if you do a little bit of pinvoke or native code with get system time adjustment, and you basically print that thing, it has an output parameter of a bool that says whether the adjustment is on or not, and then it says what the frequency is. And you basically put in a while loop and you actually let that run, and it will likely say something like false, like it's not on at this point, and it would just do that. And then you change your system clock, say, you know, 1 minute forward. What happened now is that, you know, this thing has shifted a little bit, right? Like, you know, we need to be at 1 minute in the future a little bit sooner. So what is that guy going to do? The MTP server, or the MTP Windows time service, is actually going to give a signal to this, you know, system time adjustment thing by calling the set system time adjustment to turn it on and say every time this guy ticks, basically increment it with 15.65 milliseconds. So the thing is going to go faster till the point it catches up. The opposite way, it's going to make the clock go slower. So essentially, everything that has to do with timers like thread.sleep is based on this thing. Thread.sleep, system.threading.timer, it's all based on this clock. It doesn't have anything to do with physical time, the time that you get by doing get system time or any of those things. And so you get all of those things that you see here. So if you do this get system time adjustment, you can see that with your own eyes. Basically change the clock to the control panel applet and then do something like W32TM/resync or something. Resync/force, I believe. That's the Win32 time service.
Okay.
That thing will talk to the MTP server and notice that your clock is out of sync with the MTP server, like the time.windows.com server or whatever it's configured as, or your domain controller if you're in an enterprise. And then it will actually apply an adjustment tool, and you will see this thing starting to go to true. There is an adjustment going on, and you know this number here will have a different partner number for the system clock increments. And so your clock will go faster or slower. Don't change it too much. If you change it too much, sometimes they make a jump. Like they don't want to catch up for a day or something. But you can effectively see this. If you do this and you take a look at the second hand and control panel, you know, and you have big time to catch up, you see that thing going either crazy or that slow. Like you can really see the effect there. So all of this is just to say that when you look at this picture, this thing is a little bit interesting as being misguided. The reason is what we are doing is we are scheduling here with time spans, relative time. We are doing computations based on absolute time. Those two things do not line up. Now, some systems have systematic drift, which means that those things systematically drift and need to be corrected all the time. Like on a Hyper-V machine, for example, in the lab, we saw like, you know, quite some drift on this thing on the host. Like the guest things might have different characteristics. But so if you look at this, we've actually seen on a 24-hour timer, we've seen differences in the order of 10 seconds. So you basically go to system threading timer or anything that's like time-based, and you say, please sleep for 24 times 60 times 60 times 1,000, right? And then you wake up and you do subtraction of daytime offsets. You haven't seen 24 hours. You've seen 24 hours minus or plus 10 seconds. And so what happens here is that people had, and that's where that false sense of security comes in, people wanted always more of this timer. They said, well, if I put daytime offset console write lines in this thing, where is it? Here, the user code is console write line daytime offset all the time. I basically could set my clock by it. Yeah, you can sort of set your clock by it if your system clock doesn't change, because then things either go silent or they go too fast. And secondly, yeah, this works great for like second intervals or something. Now what if you do a 24-hour interval? You do a 24-hour interval and we're 10 seconds early. So what's this thing going to say? This logic is going to compensate for that. It's going to say, now we were doing something 24 hours in the future, we were 10 seconds too early. Let's do the next thing 24 hours plus 10 seconds. What's 10 seconds on 10 hours for systematic drift? It's nothing. It's negligible. So the next time will be 19.99 seconds early. Like, we can't reach the turtle. It's Achilles and the turtle, right? Like, you're trying to catch up by saying, let's go a little faster, but like the little increment that you have there doesn't make up for anything. So this was a false sense of security, because if you had low low tick frequencies, like it sort of did seemingly the right thing. But for the large things, it was not doing it anyway.
Okay.
So, long story short, what did we do about this? Now, is not allowed in the link layer anymore. Other than for timestamp. Like if you do access.timestamp, which takes an observable of t to an observable of timestamp of t, we just read the clock every time an event goes and we put a timestamp on it. That's fine, that's just capturing it as data. But there is no state in here anymore that sort of knows about now and this computation is based on it. So we do two things now. First of all, let's actually erase a couple of things here now. Instead of going through this recursive guy all the time, we now say, also for other reasons, whenever we need to do something periodic, like observable.interval, observable.sample, observable.window, observable.buffer, like there are a lot of those guys that take in a periodic interval. And for those guys, we say, we'll look for an interface called iScheduler periodic. And if we find that guy, that's through a service provider pattern, we'll actually call through it. And the way it looks is like returns an iDisposable from the schedule method, which takes in a t over here, a time span, which is the period, okay, that's the periodic interval, comma, and then a func from t to t. That's for the iteration. So basically, it calls that guy the first time, you do your work, you return a new t, and then after that period, we'll call you again. And that actually does whatever the underlying timer does. Like, for example, the system threading timer will actually align those things at the beginning of your callbacks. And then if your callback takes a long time, it's even possible your callback goes longer than the period, then you would actually get a reentrant call over here on different thread pool thread. The reason we go for a func of t to t means that the scheduler periodic needs to protect against that. Some do. The message loop ones, well, they're on a single thread. They don't have this problem. So we don't want to fix the problem over here for those guys for things that we don't need to fix it for because they don't have the problem. So we say every scheduler implementing iScheduler periodic needs to ensure that this function can only be called once. Otherwise, what does it mean to call this thing? Because it is really like a loop, right? It's like update the state. You can only update the state after the user has completed and returned a new value.
Sure.
And so there's an async lock around that if you use thread pool or anything like that. So you can actually have requests queuing up if that happens. So you shouldn't overstay your welcome in some sense. Like if you stay too long in the callback, generally you have problems in Rx. Like, you know, a callback that takes a long time might actually stall a queue. Like you're blocking the on-next channel. You should be out of there as soon as you can.
But how can you control that depending upon what your callback does?
Mm-hmm.
Like if your callback's making calls over a network as part of a
good
code.
Question. Yes.
Yeah.
So what you do in that case is you offload it by actually introducing another queue. So you say like I have access and I need to do something in my subscribe to access that takes a long time. So like if I do subscribe X goes to something that takes a long time. What you would do is you would fix that by actually inserting over here .observeOn. And here you would pass in the new thread scheduler, for example. So they would do when this guy calls on next, it would actually go into a queue over here. So this thing returns immediately. It's just an enqueue operation. So this guy is never blocked. And things end up in that queue, and then there's a new thread here that actually drains that queue and runs those callbacks. And of course, that's fine if you have bursts. You don't want this thing like to block because like you're doing some long work. But then, like, at some point, of course, you want to be seeing that queue going to zero again. Otherwise, it keeps accumulating endlessly long. But so that's the way you would actually fix this.
And time still marches forward as you're doing all
that
work. You just keep coming back and checking to see whether or not it's done.
Exactly. That's what this guy does. It bumps a loop to actually get the queue.
Okay.
So we have this time. The recurring time mechanism of scheduler periodic that actually is being checked for. If we don't have scheduler periodic, we fall back to a scheme as you saw before, but not based on daytime offset, but based on stopwatches. So what all of this means is that the time span that you have here means this kind of time as the CPU sees it.
OK. Okay.
Time spent means, like, if you would pass this to task.delay, you get this time. If you pass it to dispatcher time, you get this time. You never get this wall clock time notion. Hmm. Like, that's the way things are in the operating system. So we say, like, we go for this notion exclusively. When you are passing in time spent, you know we're going to pass that forward to something that just works on relative time. So it's the equivalent of doing a thread.sleep, which also is based on this, of course.
Mm.
Like, it's how the OS, basically, every time there is a tick, decrements, you know, the time you still have to sleep. And when that time goes to zero, it wakes your thread up and it becomes runnable or schedulable. Mm. So that's the way that basically works. This has the additional benefit of performance. It reduces a lot of closures because of that recursive mechanism, which is really an action calling itself and, you know, sort of having to close over that thing. It's a little bit like the Y combinator, like if you go to functional style of doing things. Like, every iteration through that recursive scheduling thing causes disposable objects to be allocated, closures to be allocated. Like, for high frequency things, that's not very nice.
Mm.
So scheduler periodic is better from that point of view. It's also playing nice to the underlying system. Because, like, since, for example, Windows 7, and now I'm talking much lower on the layer diagram, but, like, in Windows 7, for example, they introduced timer coalescing in the operating system, which means if you have multiple of those periodic guys,
mm-hmm.
they can coalesce the timers by moving them a little bit and saying, mm-hmm. like, yeah, I don't need to raise two callbacks here. I can basically bundle them up when they go up to user mode. I can say, like, now, at this point, I know two timers have to fire. They were apart a little bit, like a few milliseconds, but we coalesced them.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and what that means is, like, by telling more to the underlying system about our intent to do things periodically, they can do things like battery saving and all of those kind of things. When you do single-shot timers, they don't know what's going on. Oh, another timer for 4.9 seconds, another timer for 5.1 seconds, another timer for 4.95 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's always different, and, like, you can't see the forest for the trees if you're the poor guy underneath Link, right?
Sure.
Now you can, because you see a call here to, ah, I need to do something periodically. And so for things like dispatcher timer, WinRT timer, all of those guys, we use the periodic overloads. So
great.
So that's all of that. Now, the remaining question is, what with things that use absolute time? We have those overloads as well, where you say, I want to schedule something in Rx that does something at Christmas next year. Just to give an example here, observable.timer for the 25th of December, that's European notation, 2012.
Yes.
Okay. So then something needs to happen, and then you do subscribe here, X goes to, or I don't care what that is, and you run your code to play Happy Christmas song or
okay.
something. So that's your timer. How did that work in Rx? Ah, well, the only thing that you have underneath was actually relative time. We say we get a datetime offset here. Let's do a subtraction. This time minus the current time is the relative time you have to catch up. And what are we now? Like, we're 6.12 and we're actually releasing Rx, so that's the final build number. Minus this, well, you can already see, well, it's actually 12.6.
Yeah, European notation. Right?
Yes, I would basically crash, like, you know, airspace things or something like
you
know, different units of measurement.
Like, absolutely.
It's kind of terrible. But so, like, this is like 6.5 months or something, right? Like, that you have sitting here. 6.5 months with 10 seconds a day of drift, you're gonna wish Christmas either way too early or way too late in the extreme case. So you don't want this to happen. That's
yeah.
what happened, actually. So what we do for the absolute time, guys, is, well, the only thing you can basically do with all the primitives, like the system threading timer, is relative time scheduling. So you have to do some computation anyway. And so what we have now is, for all the local schedulers, when you schedule something with absolute time, all of those things go into a centralized timer queue that says when things need to happen, 25th, 12th, 1st of January, you know, 11th of February, and so on. So you basically put all of those things in the queue, and we run one timer to the head of the queue to basically look whether work is due.
Mm.
We don't do it at this particular delta between now and the first item in the queue. We do it at a certain threshold, something like 0.99 times this thing, so that we are early. If we are early and you know your clock is going too fast or too slow, we can always compensate for it. If we arrive too early and we see we're not due yet, oh, too bad, we got called back, and we'll schedule a new timer so that we basically arrive on time. And so there's now the centralized queue. If you derive from local scheduler, basically the only member you implement is the one that uses time span. And when somebody schedules in the link layer over here, somebody schedules do something at Christmas next year, you wouldn't see a call on this guy yet. That will be dead silent. You won't see anything, in fact, unless you override the one with daytime offset and you say, I will take care of it. Mm. And sort of good luck with that, because this is pretty hard to get right. So what happens is this call is actually intercepted and put in the centralized queue, and once we get close enough to the target time, we will actually say like, oh, now it's 10 seconds due, you know, in 10 seconds you're due to do this work. We'll actually transfer it by making a call to the relative time scheduler, and you will do the work in 10 seconds from that point in time. On top of this thing, this whole thing has hooked up at the bottom of Rx. There's this thing called the Platform Enlightenment Provider. We talked about that last time.
Yep.
The thing that discovers platform capabilities. What that thing does is it also notifies us about system clock changes. Mm. So when the system clock changes, we'll reevaluate this timer. If we've already transferred to your scheduler, we'll call iDisposable on you, and we'll call you back. So anywhere in here, you know, any of that time, if you change the system clock, we won't be too early or too late.
Nice.
We'll try our very best to basically cancel that out. And so this is actually something that people can replace if you're really in an advanced scenario. You can actually implement a hosting interface here that says like how to get time notifications. The default way we do that is by running a timer that periodically checks whether we're off. You know, we basically are sampling this thing and see whether we're off with the system clock. And if that's the case, we conclude that the system clock has changed underneath us. Otherwise, you need to hook things like system events in the Win32 namespace. But system events doesn't, for example, work in Windows servers because they don't have a top-level window.
Mm.
So like we can't generally use this one. It also doesn't exist on Windows Phone and those kind of things. Like you don't have this, so you need to run a timer. Since Windows 7 and Windows Server 2008 are 2, you can actually also, in Windows services, register a callback from the Service Control Manager to tell you that the system clock has changed.
Mm.
So if you are running in a Windows service, you may want to hook that interface in. But it's something that's settable. By default, we just do something based on a periodic timer that checks the system time.
Awesome. So, if only people knew how complicated time is.
Time is way too complicated.
I mean, it's impressive how hard it is.
Yeah. And yeah, there are even more things that I haven't mentioned here. Like in certain cases, you know, we need to run stopwatches. But then if there is a gap in your time because of applications going into the dormant state,
mm-hmm.
we need to patch up that time when the application wakes up again. Like, because otherwise, like we've seen a stopwatch and there's a gap of hours in there. It's a stopwatch. It's based on relative time, on absolute time.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't suffer from system clock change, so drift and all of those kind
sure.
of things.
Sure. Starts at a specified time in your code.
Exactly.
Execution.
Yes. But so the way that the dormant state in, for example, Windows Phone works, or also like the mechanism that we have in Windows 8, is like the app is basically suspended and can be taken away. Pages can be, you know, put on disk and all
mm-hmm.
of that stuff. And when you navigate back, it comes back alive.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really the app is suspended like a virtual machine, and Hyper-V gets suspended. When you start it up again and it starts ticking, all of a sudden, you know, that timer is going forward.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, it's basically compensating, but not really compensating. It doesn't know it was gone for a while. And so basically if you have things like query performance counter,
mm-hmm.
which is sitting underneath stopwatch, that thing just had the initial stopwatch number and the current one. And like it will notice this gap, like that gap will be in there. Like it wouldn't be the time that the stopwatch was ticking while the application was running. It's also because there's like some global variable sitting there that says the stopwatch started at this point, that was the query performance number. So stopwatch.elapsed, for example, will count for more time than the app was alive.
So one of the questions they have, you know, this because in Windows 7 or Windows 8, you know, there's the similar different, it's not the same implementation, obviously,
mm-hmm.
but it still has the, you know, the freeze-dried kind of thing,
yes.
where your app goes into a suspended state,
mm-hmm.
minimal number of services will be running if, for example, they open ports or whatnot. Mm-hmm. But the thing that both of the systems give code, user code, is an event.
Yes,
right?
Exactly.
So I'm suspending. Mm-hmm. So if I'm suspending, I'm going to say, you know what? Reset my counters, man.
Exactly. And that's what we have here.
Yeah.
You're just nailing it here. We have something called iHost Lifecycle Notification.
Great.
Notification. And this interface is actually implemented for Windows 7 and Windows Phone. Windows Phone 8 and Windows Phone 7 and
there
Windows,
is no Windows
8, like, you know, all those numbers.
Sure.
So we have that actually implemented here in the System Reactive Platform Services DLL. So those guys implement that, they register it, and all of the guys that have this notion of, like, I have a stopwatch and I need to be notified when this thing stops, they get a notification. And this only happens at the scheduler layer. Again, like, you know, in the link layer, we don't want to bubble up those messages saying, like, the system clock has changed. This thing shouldn't know about that.
Absolutely.
So that's actually everything I have to tell about time today.
Wow.
Like,
that's a good fair amount of time.
A bit of stuff, yeah.
That's really great. You guys have done a lot of work. Mm-hmm. You have done a lot of work in terms of the implementation and design.
Yep.
So let's move on to
error handling.
Error handling, everyone's favorite topic.
Oh yes, error handling is one of those other things you don't want to touch.
Yeah, especially in the asynchronous world.
Exactly. Yep. So, let me actually take a sip here first.
Yes, of course. Yeah. Your trademark Coke Zero.
Mm-hmm.
They should pay you.
Yeah, maybe. Well, maybe they are.
Are they?
not yet. This is a public, you know, request for that. So, error handling. Mm-hmm. What's going up with that thing? So say, again, you have observable.interval. I'm going to draw two lines this time. Observable.interval has your iObservable sequence, that's over here, iObservable of long. Is that a good color, actually, for the camera?
Black would be better.
I'll do black. Okay, good. So iObservable of long, giving you callbacks, right? Every time the timer ticks, you have a callback and you can run some user code over here. Right?
Yep.
Where does that callback come from? In particular, if you're sitting over here, right, and you take a look at your call stack window, what would be on there? Well, you would be seeing an on next on the timer, of course, sitting somewhere. You would see your user code, like user code. You would see the on next call coming to you. And if you go all the way down the stack, you would see a scheduler. That's the guy who's sending out the message. That's this guy, scheduler. So the scheduler can, for example, be a thread pool thread. Or it could be a dispatcher time or anything of that, basically calling into your code. What happens if you throw an exception here is an interesting question that people have asked. So far, we've actually said, well, it's the same as with .NET events. If you throw an exception from the callback, it's going to bubble up, you know, the invocation of the multicast delegate, and somebody is going to see it. And what are they going to do with it? Well, I don't know. So there are different strategies top level here. Like, say this is the task pool, you would actually get a task unobserved exception event. If it's Wind Farms, you would get an application exception, I think, event. If it's WPF or Silverlight or the Windows runtime, you know, implementation, would actually get something like unhandled exception, I believe it's called, on the application object, unhandled exception. So you still have those global things that actually tell you about an exception happening. So that's neat. You know, you can basically go there and basically go to the event logs and say the exception is handled. I've seen it. Like, please don't take me down. But so that's a very global thing, and we don't want to have those global mechanisms in Rx. We don't want to have global statics or something, because it's a library. Next thing that happens is, like, you have your library sitting here, right? Then you have somebody else who builds a library, and they're going to say, oh, I'm going to basically set this global thing in my library. And then you have another library sitting here that's also trying to set that. Now I already don't know which one is going to win. Like, those global events are great for an application. Like, an application can say, I want to hook that event. But those guys shouldn't. Like, it's only the application that should be setting that. But you can't enforce that. So it feels kind of icky to have those global things sitting there. And sometimes they're necessary evil, but like, you know, we can do something slightly better here.
Sure.
So we're doing a number of things. First of all, an ICE scheduler can be wrapped with something that catches exceptions or lets you filter them. So you can do S, which is my scheduler, dot catch of the exception type, say for example invalid operation exception. And then you say exception goes to, you handle the exception, and you return true or false. True means I handled it, false means retrow it.
Okay.
If you retrow it, it will go up to any of those guys, if there is any of those guys sitting there. Because if you use the new thread scheduler, there's no global thing for that. So for the new thread scheduler, if you return true, if you return false, the exception is retrown, the thread will die, and with the thread will the whole application.
Sure.
That's the behavior. So you can now intercept the schedulers by doing dot catch on them. So if you do, for example, in this case, observable.interval of 1 second, comma, scheduler.threadpool, something like that, you can now put dot catch on that guy and protect it. And you can declare those guys globally in your application, don't care, you just pass them in the right places. And so there's no hidden schedulers in Rx, they're always explicit to things being faster. So you can wrap those guys to actually protect yourself against this kind of thing. So that's the first first aspect. Now there's an additional aspect on what happens if this stack is unwinding. Like, what do we need to take down? And so let me actually now draw a slightly different diagram here, where I still use a thread pool scheduler, or a timer, but I also use a different sequence. So let's do two sequences. T, which is my timer, it's firing every second. Okay? And then I have another sequence over here, which has a value once in a while. And then I have, let me call this axis, and then I have combined latest between those two guys. What combined latest does is whenever there are two values, it will actually send out the combination of those two guys, right? Using a selector function. So it always combines the two latest guys. The way to think about this is two cells in Excel. Cell A1, cell A2, and the sum. Whenever any of the cell changes, the sum cell needs to change, right?
Okay.
So you have this thing, oops, in this case it's that one, so the dotted lines are the combiner functions, and these are the next ones of combined lates.
Sure.
So now you get this nice diagram. Now what's the interesting thing about the callbacks? If you look at the call stacks of the callbacks here, is they can be on two places. They can be the call stacks of axis, like here it's a call stack of axis. Because axis send a new message and we have a message on the other channel, we take that one out of a field, we combine it, and we send it out. So you're borrowing the call stack of axis, the observer, to send things out. Now here, in this particular case, this one produced a new value. We had a value for axis sitting there somewhere in a field. We'll combine it, and we're actually sitting on T's call stack. So what happens now is, if you throw an exception in the user code over here versus in the user code over here, you're taking down a different call stack. Like in this case, you're taking down the call stack of whoever is producing X, which might be a scheduler. In this case, you're taking down the guy who's pumping the timer. So on the way out, we weren't really cleaning up all of the subscriptions we have here. So here we have two sequences. If you would actually throw an exception from a callback that happens to be on axis, the thing would die, and if you would do a catch or something or a global exception filter, the thing would die, but your application would still be alive. And what's going on now is that this timer is orphaned. You don't have any disposable to it anymore that's reliable, because like all sorts of invariants, while the stack was unwinding, didn't hold anymore. Maybe you already replaced some disposable or whatever. So when this exception happens, like this thing is sort of semi-unreachable. Like you might be lucky that you can still go to the disposable of combined latest and you dispose on it and the timer goes away, but there were no guarantees really about that. And so what we do now is if the exception goes unhandled while we're unwinding the stack, this disposable will be disposed as well. So both subscriptions to those guys will go out in flames as well. So that's also because it's not recoverable. Like, this doesn't mean, return true doesn't mean I handled it and please continue on. Because we can't continue on. Like, this exception happened in the middle of something. Mm. Like, we might already have stashed the field of one of those two sides into, or the value in one of the fields. Then we're calling the combiner function throws. Oh my goodness, what do we have to do now? It's almost like you need to have a transaction to back out the field to retry it again. You can't do that kind of stuff. So we say, this is a last chance to avoid caching. It's not to be able to redo the operation, because like otherwise all sorts of state needs to be checkpointed. And that's just a lot of, you know, stuff to do that can't even be guaranteed to be correct necessarily. Sure. So proper cleanup is basically what this is about. So preventing of caching, proper cleanup. There's one more place where we do proper cleanup, and that actually brings us to the from events pattern thing.
Okay.
Which is, you know, the last important subject.
Sure.
So,
well, I mean, you know, exceptions are exceptional.
Yes, yeah.
And you should never just continue on and expect that everything's
exactly.
Okay.
Yes. And that's not really what we
that's
did before in some sense. Although, you know, this timer might still have been going, and so it might still have been combining, you know, values, right? Like, this guy died, this call stack was gone, exception got swallowed, and now this time is still, this guy is still ticking. So you might have seen those guys coming out, those combines, combined latest, because there was a stale value sitting somewhere.
Sure.
Like, now those results all the way here don't mean anything anymore.
Exactly.
Like you have, like, nonsense kind of things going on.
But being able to give me... the right error information is critical.
Yeah, exactly. And so now you can handle them. And in fact, all the things we did is we guarantee that those things actually get called. Like in the past, there were cases where those things wouldn't get called.
Hmm.
Like because there was some excessive try catch around certain things like the thread pool scheduler, for example. Because the thread pool scheduler, that's an interesting story as well, actually. Not the thread pool, the task pool scheduler in .NET 4.5 has changed a little bit for the async stuff.
Mm.
Like in the past, so you get this task unhandled or task unobserved exception event raised that basically tells you that something went wrong. In the past, so basically when this thing fires, it's an interesting story. Like if you have a task, right? If you do task dot, let me use the new syntax, task dot run, returns something, and that something throws. So now I have a task, and I'm using the wrong color again. So we have a task sitting here, and basically you orphan that task, right? Like you don't have any references to it anymore. You don't have a continue with sitting here as well.
Mm-hmm.
Like you have nothing. And this thing throws at some point. Well, where does the exception come out? That's the question. And the answer is, well, all tasks have a finalizer. And when the finalizer runs, which is might be a long time from now, because first you need to get GC'd and then it needs to come up to the finalization queue, when the finalizer actually runs, it notices that this task has an exception object in it that nobody has observed. Hence it says, I'm gonna throw from the finalizer. That's basically what the TPL did since 4.0, or whenever they shipped the first time. Now this isn't kind of nice if you have async functions or async methods that are void returning, for example, or async task, and you don't observe those guys because you do fire and forget asynchrony, it would take down your classes.
Mm.
So they say we're still gonna call the task unobserved exception event, but we're not gonna take down the process by default for those guys. Because it's basically an orphan task, nobody can observe the exception. So it's you can actually read more about that on the PFX blog,
sure,
by all extensions blog. But so what happened with this finalizer thing in Rx, we said for the task pool scheduler in Rx, we don't want this to die a long time from now, because that's what the finalizer ultimately gives you as a side effect. So we said we're going to catch the exceptions and start a new thread that will raise the exception immediately. So you were always observing the exception, but then making it go out on a different thread so that the process would die quickly. Now that means we were actually catching it. That also meant that if you were using task pool to Rx, the task unobserved exception wouldn't fire.
Mm.
And so like this is kind of not conform the guidelines. So we say we always want those things to be able to fire because you expect to be able to intercept exceptions over there. So it's streamlining the experience in some sense.
Great.
And it also helps because in 4.5 the default behavior there is not to take down the process. So, like, otherwise, we would still always take down the process in those cases. Like, it seems then we are defeating what they are doing, so that's not nice either. So now the other thing is, if I have an observable access and I subscribe to it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I have a callback for X where I run some code, and we already know if we throw from the callback, it goes up to the scheduler, but now it's proper cleanup, right? We've seen that in the previous part. I also have an on-error handler sitting here, and I have an on-completed handler, right? For D, for disposable. Now, when the side effects of subscribe, when you call subscribe, throw an exception, where does it come out? Does it come out over here, so that if you do a try catch, the exception appears over here?
Mm.
Or does it come out on the error channel? Because we've already passed in an observer, you could tunnel it over there.
Mm.
So the question is it sort of a synchronous exception that puts it in regular catch blocks? Or is it one that gets rerouted into the exception over here? And so, again, there was a little bit of an inconsistency depending on situations. And so what we're doing now internally in Rx is we're saying we're never going to subscribe to a source plane. We're not going to do a plane subscription to unknown sources. We're always going to do something called subscribe safe, which puts a try catch under the underlying subscribe call and reroutes exceptions to this thing. So they always come out over there. Now, why do we do that? Well, a couple of things here. First one is if you have an async function or an async method in C# 5 or VB, async task x, right? And say you do an await over here, right? You're awaiting task T, some task, and you throw an exception here. Where does that exception come out? It's after the await.
Hmm.
So it's in a continuation. Where does it have to come out? It comes out on the task. So if you do task.continuef, you would see it there. If you would await the task, that would be the place where it throws.
Hmm.
But it was wired to the callback channel. It wasn't wired to a synchronous channel because there is no synchronous channel anymore. You're after the await of T. This code might be running on a thread-to-pool thread, might be running on the message loop again. Like, you wouldn't be able to catch it if we didn't wire it through to the task. What happens if the throw exception is before the await? You may say, well, I call X, the exception should come out immediately because we're not awaiting anything yet. The answer is no, it also goes to the task for consistency. So, in other words, that's the same thing we're doing here. We always wire it to the exception channel as opposed to the synchronous channel. By the way, this is exactly the same as for iterators, not surprisingly, because the implementation of the state machine thing for await is pretty much the same implementation as the yield return for iterators. So if you have iterators, and actually lots of people get burned by that, in an iterator if you do this, I enumerable of T, say I'm writing the select operator, well, select would return an R, like where of T with something that takes in an IEnumerable as the input and a filter and all of that stuff. Like, a lot of people say, you know, if access equals null, throw argument null exception, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then in here they will do for each var x in access, if filter of x holds true, yield return x, right? They would write this piece of code. Now, what's the problem? When does this exception throw? It's not when you call where, because that state machine hasn't started yet. It's when you do the first move next on the getEnumerator. So you would see those exceptions coming out when you do a for each, as opposed to when you're composing your query. So if you're doing access.where of null, and then you don't do anything, there's no exception happening here.
Mm.
The exception is delayed till you do a for each x in access over here, that's the for each keyword. You basically see the exception coming out over there. So that's also a delayed execution kind of thing, right? So it's pretty much the same. The toe happens before the first yield. It's still lifted into, in this case, the move next channel, which is the same thing as the on error channel in Rx, right? So move next throwing is the same as on error. Those are basically same sides or different sides of the same coin. And so we do that now routinely. Now the reason that came up is this one. Let's actually show an interesting example. If you do this, from underscore in timer of 5 seconds, right? From x in axis, select x. And I will replace axis in just a second for something more interestingly. Well, this is 5 seconds. After 5 seconds, the timer fires and assigns value 0 long to this guy. And then the callback runs to basically evaluate this thing. So the expression that's sitting over here is evaluated after 5 seconds. Some people think that's evaluated synchronously. That's not the case. Like, this is a select many in disguise. It's really like timer of 5 seconds dot select many of underscore goes to axis. That fat thing I have sitting there. So this thing is really sitting in a lambda. So it's delayed execution. The lambda arrow is sitting here, hidden in the syntax between the two froms is an arrow. Like every two froms are an arrow, or a lambda expression in some sense. So this is delayed execution. What do we do when we get access? When we evaluate access, we have a new UI observable. What do we have to do to that thing in order to pump results out? Guess what? We have to subscribe, right? Now what if subscribe trips? Where does that happen? It happens in the callback of the timer. The timer gives me a callback, I get access, and I subscribe to access during that call. During an onNext call, it's an onNext call of the timer. This thing says onNext of 0 long, that's this value, computes access, it doesn't subscribe. If this thing throws, you're throwing from onNext, which is what we discussed just previously, mm-hmm. right? Throwing from onNext now doesn't take down the whole thing. But in this case, it's not a top level on next. Like this basically, when an exception happens here, it's happening in user code. Like it's a custom sequence that's doing things. Like where does an exception need to come out? Doesn't seem like the query should go down in flames. It means that this exception needs to come out on the on error channel of Y's. Because if we throw, we're throwing to a scheduler. And the user that's sitting here, Y's.subscribe, he wouldn't see exception goes to something, even though there was an exception happening somewhere over here. Like, you still want to see that exception over here. Like, you're the user, you want to see that. So that's why we use subscribe safe. This is an unknown sequence, we say subscribe safe, which means if an exception happens, we'll reroute it through the error channel. So that's basically what's going on here.
Great.
Now, why does this come into place? And that's where the whole WinRT story comes in, is what really happened is somebody had code that looked a little bit like this. It's just conceptually the same. Was slightly different, but the same effect. What was happening here is from X in, and he had over here something like text changed events. Okay? So text change was observable from event pattern of the text box, comma, the text changed event. Doesn't matter which overload you're using or from event pattern, as you know, we have plenty of overloads, ones that use reflection, ones that don't. Same effect. So you have this text changed event sitting here, and basically what was happening was here, there was text changed. What does text change do when you do a subscribe to that guy? Because that's what's happening here, right? Hidden behind this is ultimately there will be a subscribe call to this guy. In the context of the timer, you know, there was this arrow sitting there, the hidden arrow. The subscribe to from event pattern does a plus equal at event handler to text changed. Where does it happen? The timer set on next, producing a value, called this lambda function, did a subscribe on the result. meer on the thread pool. On the thread pool, it's a no-no to do plus equals on the UI element. That wasn't the case in WPF and Silverlight. In fact, it may have been the case in certain cases, because it was an implementation detail. Mm. So you could already have had a cache with this kind of code in, you know, Rx before, because there was no synchronization where the plus equal and the minus equal went. Because we actually said, well, you can compose that in yourself. You can say, from event pattern, I want to do subscribe on the dispatcher, which means when a subscription happens here, the side effects of the subscription are posted to the dispatcher where you can do the plus equal. But then you need to, you know, put this thing on all of those places, and it has some interesting problems. The problem with subscribe on is this. If you look at the timeline, right? Again, wrong color. If you look at the timeline, and you have the timeline of your events, right? This is my event. And then you have the timeline of event being from event patterned, so it's an iObservable. Okay. So this is the underlying event, this is the iObservable world over here. This is .NET event, or WinRT event, doesn't matter. And so we do event from event pattern over here dot subscribe on a certain scheduler. Subscribe on a certain scheduler. What happens is, if at some point, say over here, I'm doing a subscribe to this whole animal. I'm subscribing to it, what happens? The subscription needs to happen on a given scheduler. We need to post it to that scheduler. Mm. We can't block for it, because if we block for it, we might deadlock the whole thing. So we need to do an asynchronous post to that scheduler to do the subscription. So there's another scheduler sitting here where we're posting that to. Arguably the one where you can do thread safe additions or event handlers or whatever. So this might take a while till that event gets processed and the event is hooked up. So the plus equal happens at a later point in time. It might happen here. Even though you subscribed before this event, you didn't see it. You're losing events, you have a time gap, you know, you have a little time gap sitting here that you don't get the events because the addition is happening asynchronously. So that's a problem. Mm. And so subscribe on dispatcher would have that issue. And so we didn't really want to have that in general, because like if in here, in your callbacks, there's always postback happening, people would come and scream and say, oh my goodness, you know, I'm losing events. And we've actually had those kind of, you know, things on the forums where people said, you know, I have something like access. I'm grouping my access with group by based on some key selector, right? Mm-hmm. And then I'm doing an observe on is another guy, an observe on of all the groups on a certain scheduler over here. So now that's going on. What's the problem with this? Is that all the groups that are being produced are being put on the scheduler, and then the rest of the callback is happening here. Like, you know, the rest of the code might be doing something like select many of the group goes to all the elements in the group. So I'm basically flattening everything. So I'm grouping access by, you know, different inner streams based on certain keys, and then I'm basically flattening all of those guys into a result sequence. So like all the elements that I'm seeing here are being projected again onto this line. The thing is, if the stream of groups that you have here, that's the stream of groups, if you make the subscription to those groups asynchronous, the subscriptions are going to happen at a later point in time. Mm. One might happen here, one might happen here, one might happen here, which means I'm losing messages from those guys, because you're introducing a time gap. And if we give you a group, you need to immediately subscribe to it synchronously. And this introduces an async kind of time gap. You would have exactly the same with the from event pattern kind of fix. Mm. So observe on is typically not a problem if the thing that's being observed on is not sequences by itself. Like if you have that, you know, you have a race between when you subscribe to it and when the sequence ends up in that queue. Like it's getting in the queue, it gets out of the queue, and then you subscribe to it. The time it was in the queue, nobody was listening to it. So you have a gap sitting there.
Sure.
So that's the problem with this kind of code. So what we did for From Event Pattern, again, long story short, is we said, where you write the From Event Pattern sort of matters. Like, you would actually write it where you would write the plus equals yourself. So say you would hook up event handlers to the text box, where would you do that? Initialize component, form load, any of those kind of places. So you write From Event Pattern there, and what we do is we capture synchronization context.current, so we know where we have to do things. Unfortunately, there is no generalized way to look at an object and say, this object needs to have all of its operations done over there, over there, or over there. There was something like that a long time ago in system.component model. It was something called isynchronize invoke, which actually WinForms uses. So you could walk up to a WinForms object and say, you know, you guy, do you implement this interface? If so, I know where I should post my messages to talk to you. Like in general, today we don't have that concept anymore. The other unfortunate thing is actually that even if you would have that, it would still not work. Why is that? Because From Event Pattern, right, has an overload that takes in an add and remove handler delegate. So you do From Event Pattern, given a handler, do button dot click plus equals h, comma, h goes to button dot click minus equals h. Imagine your Rx. You're the From Event Pattern guy, you get those two delegates passed in. How do you know the delegate uses button inside? It's opaque, like you just get like some system.delegate thing sitting there. And you don't know the object that that thing is referring to. Ideally, you would want to have something like method group conversions for the add and the remove pairs, which like method group conversions exist in C# for methods, right? So you can do action of string equals console write line. Just writing console write line means create a delegate for it because you're assigning it. Here you would want something like From Event Pattern for button click and maybe something you want like, maybe you want to replace this with pseudo syntax. You want to really write button dot add underscore click, which is the internal name. Like then you would have a method group conversion to a delegate that's the add click method with this as the sender or the target. And then you could fish that out. But that's all very hypothetical. If you would have this, you would still need to have an interface by looking at that thing that you know where to talk to. And for WinForms controls, we sort of have that, but like for WPF controls, well, you already have the problem of you need to find the dispatcher object base class. And you couldn't do that in the link layer. There is no place in the link layer to do this kind of dynamic checks. Because like this is a Windows-based thing. It lives in a different assembly. If you do the same with WinRT, well, you will have another object that lives in Windows.WinMD or something. Like, you can't explore those kind of things easily without having this platform services and or, you know, the, you know, Windows.threading assembly. So, like, From Event Pattern lives over here, and all of those guys know somehow where to post things back. But like that knowledge is sitting everywhere. Like we need some resolution scheme that's way too complicated. So we said, simple solution, kind of, you know, it's not the ideal one, but it's, you know, the best one we can come up with is capture the current synchronization context, post back subscriptions to that one, and compare the synchronization context to where you are at that point. It's a common trick. If the current synchronization context equals the ones that you captured, you can do a synchronous invocation. So basically, if in this sample that I have sitting here, it's a little bit cut off at this point. If I do timer 5 seconds on the thread pool, and I have the observable From Event Pattern sitting in my button click handler, over here we capture the, let's say, WinRT synchronization context. That means that when time comes to do a subscribe over here, we'll post this thing back to the WinRT context. Pretty simple solution. If over here the timer would not be running on the thread pool, but it would be running in the core dispatcher on WinRT, let me actually write it out, core dispatcher scheduler. This means this message happens on the dispatcher, which means this evaluates on the dispatcher, which means the subscribe happens on the dispatcher, which means it's on the same synchronization context, which means we wouldn't do a post. because we're on the same place as where we started. So it has this check for equality between the one that we captured here and the one that we're on at this point. And so that's how we also avoid this time gaps. Mm. If you're in the same place, you can do it immediately, as opposed to going to a post.
Sure.
Because if you go to a post, there might be other controls, post-back events that execute on the message loop, right? And there's some additional thing behind from event pattern. In fact, we back it by a subject now, so that there's only ever one subscription to the event handler underneath for any given number of simultaneous connections to the from event pattern. Mm. So basically, that means if you stack exchange multiple times in your query, we'll share the same event handler underneath. If the number drops to zero, we'll unsubscribe, of course. And the unsubscription by itself is also like a little bit of a dangerous thing, because the dispose call will execute the minus equal, which also needs to be posted back to the right place. So there's a lot of things that fell out of this, but it's actually for the better, I would say.
Sure.
Because also, like in other platforms, like, you know, Windows Phone, you have similar issues. They just don't surface that much because there's less of a discipline in, you know, the UI stack there to routinely throw exceptions if you're in the wrong place. Because in certain cases, you know, if you just grab a lock or something, you can still do it. And in RT, they basically said, well, let's make this like, let's start from a clean slate and actually say whenever you're on the wrong place, let's throw. Which also means towards the future, like something that used to work in the past because accidentally we could make it happen or make it work, like no longer that holds you from evolving. Like if in the future you say, well, we don't have a secret sauce anymore to make this work accidentally, and people rely on the fact that the event handlers worked when you added them from a different thread, like now you have something that's blocked, right? Like you can't move forward, like you have a backwards compatibility kind of thing. So throwing is the best way there, and so we now deal with that kind of thing.
Great.
And even if it doesn't work out, you would do a subscribe safe here, which means the exception would come out on something that's already erased. So your exception would actually come out properly on the observer. If you don't observe the exception, it would bubble up. It might actually go to one of those catch guys, also erased at this time. Or ultimately, it would come up to the unhandled exception event of the core application or the application object that you're dealing with.
Sure, so and that would be the UI thread.
The UI thread, exactly. Which is the global place, and in fact, if you use a Metro application on Windows 8, by default, if you're in debug mode, all unhandled exception will do a debug and break. And so you will actually see that thing coming out there. It will say something like, you know, add event handler call marshaled from a wrong thread or something. And that will actually mean that you did exactly the same as, for example, in WinForms, you can't touch UI from a different place. So it's the same kind of exception. The message is a little bit different. And you would actually look at the call stack and you would see like something like from event pattern, and you know, oh, my from event pattern is not sitting in the right place. It's not capturing the right synchronization context. And so the guidance is pretty simple. Keep all the things that are from, like observable from, keep all of those things out of your queries. Because by their very nature, they're pretty long. They're bridging code. They're glue. Like you keep all your glue in one place, and then you use it in your query, meaning that your query looks nice as well. You see text changed over here, as opposed to this whole animal sitting over here, right? So your query looks nice, and your from event patterns are in the places where you would hook up the events, where we can capture the synchronization context and make it work for you. If you don't like that, you can use from event pattern, and we have overloads that take in the schedule. If you use those here on your own, like, you know, you might have time gaps in that case.
Sure.
So you don't want to mess around with that too much.
Excellent, man.
The nice thing is existing code that used to work on Silverlight, Windows Phone, WPF continues working.
Great.
Without making any changes.
Without making any changes?
Yep.
Wow.
Yep.
You did a lot of work.
Essentially, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Right
My
on.
Pleasure.
Well, I mean, it's clearly time has been a consistent thread through this whole discussion, even though it was the first main topic.
Time gaps, yep.
Time is important.
Exactly.
Exceptions are exceptional.
Yeah.
Deal with them intelligently. Mm-hmm. You make it easier in the asynchronous world for at least people to put exceptions in predictable places.
Exactly, yes. They're not, no longer coming out on some place you didn't expect, because
sure.
Rx is essentially a free-threaded world where, like,
it
things
needs to be.
Borrow, yes, where the exception, not the exceptions, where the messages are generated, mm-hmm. work happens.
Awesome.
And it only travels to another place in certain cases, like Observon, and, or using time-based operations, and that means that exceptions might have been in places you didn't expect them, so that's no longer the case.
Great. And now in line with Windows 8 RC.
RP.
RP. You should call it
RC and your
You should call it RP. Like RX RP.
Yeah. Well, you know, the branding has already been done. But
sure it has. Hey, great job.
Yep, thank you.
Thanks for having us here. Mm-hmm. And we'll come and see you again. I know there's going to be an RX 3.0.
Well, there's going to
so
be
hopefully
an RTM
you can get a
first.
Vacation.
There's going to be an RTM first. I'm going on vacation and I'll
I hope
see
so.
You. In Amsterdam.
Yes, and you will be on Channel 9 Live. So for the people out there, mm-hmm. make sure you watch Bart. It'll be in towards the end of June. You'll see the information. But watch this, listen to it, understand it, get some questions, and then you can ask him live.
The more questions, the better.
Rock and roll.
Good. Thank you.
Cheers.